crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we begin in the first segment by looking at the Biden administration's foreign policy once again. We are joined by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. Recently, she had a piece at The Progressive titled Biden's Foreign Policy, 10 Problems, 1 Solution. We'll talk about the issues facing the U.S. around the globe and also highlight the significance of diplomacy over violence. In the next segment of today's program, we feature the Complete Picture Project. We will be joined by Rebecca Grace and John Gray. They're the force behind the Complete Picture Project, a nonprofit whose mission is to humanize individuals facing prison for nonviolent crimes. They create videos for defense attorneys who represent defendants that come from economically disadvantaged communities, often from racial minority groups that are disproportionately incarcerated in U.S. jails and prisons. We'll talk about restorative justice in the second segment today on the Project Censored Show. Stay tuned.
Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks about the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are pleased to welcome back to the Project Censored Show, Medea Benjamin. Medea Benjamin, certainly no stranger to the folks in our audience, co-founder of Global Exchange and Code Pink Women for Peace, author of the 2018 book Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Benjamin's previous books include Kingdom of the Unjust Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, Don't Be Afraid, Gringo, A Honduran Woman Speaks from the Heart with Jody Evans, and Stop the Next War Now, Inter-Ocean Action Guide. You can follow Medea Benjamin on Twitter at Medea Benjamin. Medea, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, Mickey, so great to be on with you.
I am delighted that we were able to catch up with you because you never sit still and you are always, always on the go working for social justice causes, particularly looking for significant change in U.S. foreign policy. And today, as usual, you've been writing a lot of pieces, some at Mint Press, Code Pink, The Progressive, other places. 10 problems with Biden's foreign policy and 1 solution. So, Medea Benjamin, let's talk about Biden's foreign policy issues, but let's start right with the present, because I think I'm catching you right now in the middle of an action, a protest.
Well, that's right. And it's funny because the first one on the article was about the failure to quickly rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. And here we are in Annapolis, Maryland, outside the office of Congressman Anthony Brown. Now, he's a congressman that just put together a letter with 70 Democrats and 70 Republicans, nice bipartisan, coming together to advocate for war. No, it's a letter that basically says, the Iran nuclear deal is not good enough. You need to throw in all kinds of other things. You need to throw in Iran's ballistic missiles. You need to throw in Iran's malign regional activities. You need to throw in the human rights issues. And basically, it's a non-starter, of course, because Iran isn't going to go for that. And what deal would encompass all of those things anyway? And so it's a very dangerous letter. Because the fact that it has 70 Democrats, including some liberal and progressive Democrats, is a kind of a push to Biden not to go back into the Iran nuclear deal. And we see that as a terrible sign. And so we organize to get people outside of his office and say, what the heck are you doing? We want you to publicly say that you're in favor of going back into this nuclear deal, that the U.S. was the one to go out of it. The U.S. should be the one to go back into it. And it's the only way to avoid not only a war with Iran, but to try to resolve the conflicts in the region.
Medea Benjamin, you mentioned, of course, that word bipartisan, not something we hear too often these days, particularly around domestic affairs, but we certainly do see this bipartisanship around imperial foreign policy. Isn't that correct?
That's right. It's the one place they love to come together. The true war parties get together and the two wings on the hawk. And yes, they are amazing how much they agree in terms of just using military might instead of diplomacy, talking to our adversaries. And even though they all talk about talking, Obama or Trump or now Biden, during their election campaigns, they're always talking about ending wars and peace, but then they get into power and something happens to them and they become hawks.
Well, Biden has a long history, of course, hawkish behavior. So given that you've paid particular attention to Iran, and given Biden did at least talk some talk about some significant changes coming forward, what do you see as any shift at all between Trump to Biden on this particular issue?
Yes. So this is an issue where there were huge differences between Obama and Trump. And Obama signed this great nuclear deal that the whole world said, yes, you know, there's progress. Let's not just keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but let's build trust so we can talk about other issues. And then Trump came in and ruined all of that. And then we really thought Biden was going to come in. And this was something he was going to do like in his first week by executive order, say, hey, we're back in the deal. We're back with the World Health Organization. We're back with the Paris Accords. We're back in the Iran nuclear deal. You know, 1-2-3 punch. Instead, he's been dragging his feet on this. And every day that goes by, Mickey, is very dangerous because Iran is about to have presidential elections. The conservatives there have a leg up because of the mistrust and the terrible sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. And if Biden doesn't get back into this deal quickly, this deal might just fall apart. So that's why we feel it's so urgent. And that's why we're so disappointed with Biden for not taking the measures early. And it's not just the Iran elections coming up. Every day that goes by gives the enemies of this deal more chance to organize. And those are the lobby group AIPAC. It's the hawks in Congress. It's Israel. It's Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of people who don't want to see the U.S. go back into this deal. And Biden is just giving them more and more time to put the pressure on him.
In fact, Medea Benjamin, here in the U.S. domestically, there's a lot of attention on COVID-19, vaccine rollouts, purported returns to normalcy and wishful thinking. But you're noting, of course, that there was a U.S. airstrike in late February, that Biden, in fact, has seemingly been continuing or escalating some of these conflicts with Iraqi and Syrian groups in particular. We also, of course, see the utter lack of accountability regarding Saudi Arabia's murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So could you remark on these two issues that really aren't getting much attention in the U.S. domestic press at all, given the other points of focus?
Well, yes, I think it's good that you brought up the issue about bombing Syria, because whoever gave Biden permission to bomb Syria? Certainly he didn't go to Congress for that. And it's just another example of getting us into more conflicts in the Middle East and more militarism. And then we see that Biden has done some positive thing of allowing the American public to see this intelligence report about the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And we thank him for that. But you put out the report that everybody can see very clearly that the Saudi crown prince actually approved this brutal murder. And then what do you do about it? Nothing. He doesn't freeze the assets of the Saudi crown prince. He doesn't say you can never come to the United States again. He doesn't say we're not going to participate in meetings if you were going to be there. He doesn't send the word to the very old crotchety king of Saudi Arabia, why don't you pick somebody else in the line of succession to be the next king? Because the one you have is a brutal murder with blood all over his hands. So it's another example. We're extremely disappointed with Biden for not taking more action to send a very clear signal to the Saudis that we won't do business with the Crown Prince.
Medea Benjamin, speaking of this issue, this is a major case for international journalism. Talk about shooting the messenger. In this case, we recall when this happened, the Trump administration had a very peculiar take. They denied it, lied about it, claimed 10 other things were going on, and then basically tacitly acknowledged it while noting that there were billions of dollars on the table for an arms deal. So kind of was what it was. And of course, there were critics at the time of that approach. But now here we see the Biden administration now knowing what we suspected, that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, Washington Post journalist, and there's zero accountability and we're moving forward. What kind of damage do you think this does internationally in terms of the rights of journalists and human rights activism?
Well, it says the United States won't stick up for journalists that were working in the U.S. in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Post, right in the heart of the empire, and we're not even going to stand up for a Washington Post journalist. And of course, what is the message that it sends to dictators all over the world? Go ahead, open season. And then this is also related to another issue, Mickey, which is the issue of Yemen. Because on the one hand, it's the Saudi-led coalition that is creating this incredible catastrophe in Yemen, where a child is dying every single minute from the consequences of the war. And it's been U.S. bombs that have been killing the people of Yemen. And Biden came in having said, during the campaign, he said, called Saudi a pariah state. So he came in and he said, we're not going to sell offensive weapons anymore. And we said, okay, that's a great thing. But what are offensive weapons? You have to make a little distinction there. Because he also said, well, we're going to continue to make sure Saudi Arabia can defend itself. And there's the rub. So he put a hold on some weapons, but not all weapons, which we think we should not be selling any weapons to them. And he hasn't said to us how much the U.S. is going to totally cut any ties to the war in Yemen. No logistical support, no intelligence support, no maintenance of their planes. So there are Congress people who've said, hey, we want the details of this. And so far, we haven't seen anything. So it's another example where, yes, it's better than under Trump, where he just said, hey, what the heck, we're just going to keep selling weapons to this murderous regime. And Trump even bragged about having rehabilitated the ex-murderer, bin Salman, in the international stage. And Biden said, no, we're not going to do that. But then, once again, he won't go far enough.
You know, Medea Benjamin, this support for Saudi Arabia and the carnage that it has then unleashed in Yemen, we're talking about millions of people starving, over half the country in dire straits. Can you talk a little bit more about the conditions, about what is going on in Yemen, and what is the U.S. doing about it?
So the Saudis got involved and got a coalition together to interfere in the internal affairs of Yemen because they wanted a Saudi-friendly government in power in the neighboring country. And under Obama, we have to go back to 2015, as part of his Iran nuclear deal, since the Israelis weren't happy about it, he said, okay, we'll give you even more money. And the Saudis weren't happy about it. And he said, okay, we'll help you in Yemen. We'll join you in this horrific war. And so the U.S. got involved under Obama, even more involved during the years of the Trump administration. And what has happened is that Yemen has been destroyed. Most of its health infrastructure is destroyed, its water systems. The bombs have affected residential neighborhoods, marketplaces, weddings, funerals, all kinds of civilian gatherings. And this is with U.S. support and U.S. weapons. And then on top of that is something really horrific, which is that the Saudi coalition has been, since January, blockading the main port, Hudaydah, and not letting fuel in. And if you don't let fuel into the country, then how do you distribute food and medicines? And so it's created this horrific crisis. And unusually, it's very hard for reporters to get in. There's a very brave CNN reporter that got in illegally and took incredible footage of all of the boats lined up, not being able to dock, all of the trucks lined up, not being able to get fuel to then get the goods out into the country, and said, this is the Saudi regime that is doing this with the complicity of the United States. And that's the proof that we have. And if anybody wants to go back and look at that CNN clip, it's heartbreaking, because then she travels around and shows the people literally starving to death. And the fact that this is going on, and the U.S. and even now the Biden administration is not saying to the Saudis, lift the blockade of the ports, let the fuel in, let the food and medicines in. And not only that, Mickey, the U.S. envoy to Yemen, now appointed by Biden, this guy's name is Tim Lenderking, when he was confronted by the CNN reporter, he denied it. He said, the Saudis aren't blocking the fuel from getting in, and that food and medicines are flowing freely. And she said, I just saw it with my own eyes. It's not true. It's a lie what he said. So that is a very bad sign that the U.S. envoy is even denying a Saudi blockade that is starving children.
Medea Benjamin, definitely stark and striking, terrible news about what's happening in Yemen related to the U.S. support of Saudi Arabia. I'd like to remind our listeners that this is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have on the line Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange and Code Pink, author of 8 books, most recently Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're talking about Biden's foreign policy, and after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Medea Benjamin. Stay with us.
Sacred. Hold on, give me one right here. Hold on. You don't give money to the bums on the corner with a sign bleeding from their gums. Talking about you don't support a crackhead. What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's an addict with $1 billion a week, kill brown people habit. And even if you ain't on the front line, when Master yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness. Man, that's savage.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are honored to have Medea Benjamin join us once again, giving us an update on Joe Biden's early foreign policy. Medea Benjamin, of course, co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace, author of 8 books, including most recently Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Medea Benjamin, in a recent article that you wrote, 10 Problems with Biden's Foreign Policy and One Solution, co-authored with Nicholas J.S. Davies, we have been talking about some things happening around the world involving U.S. foreign policy and Biden's decisions. And before the break, we were talking about Saudi Arabia. Right now, I want to turn attention to another recurring theme in U.S. imperialism, and that is Venezuela. So coming from Trump to Biden, looks like increased attention being paid once again to a re-recognition of Juan Guaido in Venezuela. Can you talk about what's happening there and the Biden angle in Venezuela?
Well, isn't this absurd, Mickey, where you have a new administration coming in that could have set the record straight and said, Juan Guaido was actually never elected. So I don't know why Trump was calling him president. So we're going to set the record straight and call the person in power the president, which is Nicolas Maduro, the person recognized by the United Nations. We're not saying Biden has to say he loves him, he hates him, whatever. He is the president. So let's go from there. Take the guy who is in power and figure out how we're going to talk to him, what we're going to do to make life better for the Venezuelan people. Now, the sanctions that have been imposed during the Trump years have been so devastating that there was a UN special rapporteur that said over 100,000 Venezuelans have died because of these sanctions. And so it was a chance for Biden to show that he is a humanitarian. he likes to show us what a compassionate guy he is. And I think in many ways he is compassionate. He certainly has had a lot of tragedy in his own life. But why isn't he compassionate then when it comes to the sanctions that Trump imposed on the people of Venezuela? And why doesn't he say, okay, you know, this is a time to get real. We're going to talk to Juan Guaido. We're going to talk to the opposition. We're going to work with all the parties, but we're going to recognize that the president is Nicolas Maduro and that we have to dialogue with him so that we can help the Venezuelans get out of this morass that they're in right now, mostly caused because of U.S. sanctions.
Medea Benjamin, the absurdity is just writ large here. I mean, Guaido, Georgetown Guaido, this is a manufactured, quote unquote, resistance figure, if ever there was one. And going back last year between the New York Times and CNN and just a raft of completely bogus, propagandistic, top-down type narratives about what was going on in Venezuela. In the U.S., people don't pay, as you know, a lot of attention to foreign policy anyway. And we've seen in the last five or so more years a continued decline in coverage of foreign affairs by the U.S. corporate press. The word absurd keeps coming to mind. What else can you possibly make about Guaido, a straw person if ever there was?
Yeah, but you know, both for this, and I think we're going to talk about Cuba as well, we have to recognize that there's a strong domestic political element to all of this. And that is the conservative Venezuelan Americans. And there were just several hundred thousand of them that were given temporary protective status by the Biden administration. And we have a voting bloc in southern Florida of very conservative Latin Americans from Cuba, Colombia, Venezuela, and they're well organized. And they really have created a stranglehold on U.S. policy when it comes to Latin America, which is extremely dangerous. And I think they're the ones that are keeping us on this ridiculous path of supporting, as quote, president, somebody who has zero power to do anything presidential inside of Venezuela. You know, his people now are in charge of embassies around the world. They couldn't issue one visa. They couldn't issue a passport. They have no power to do any of that. And so, yes, it is totally absurd and obscene.
An obvious segue here to your explanation for this kind of support in the U.S. involving Cuba. We see Biden following more in the Trump footsteps on Cuba. And of course, there's a long time right-wing contingency of Cuban expats in the U.S. that have really helped bolster this. Again, the word absurd seems to be one of the hour here. The policies toward Cuba, the completely bizarre policies against Cuba. Could you comment?
Well, this is an example where there had been tremendous progress made under the Obama years. You know, it was Iran and Cuba where Obama had really made progress. And then Trump came in and undid everything and imposed more and more sanctions. So much so that now, if you're a Cuban American and want to send money to your relatives in Cuba, you can't even do that now because the Trump administration has closed the pathways for that. Now is COVID time, so we're not traveling, but they also made it harder for Americans to travel to Cuba. They put new restrictions on trade. They put Cuba, ridiculously, on a list of state sponsors of terrorism, Cuba. And they have just made it extremely hard for Cubans to get access to anything. They've even stopped countries from selling fuel to Cuba. So here we are in the middle of a pandemic where Cuba doesn't have the income from tourism, doesn't have the income from a lot of its medical personnel that was being paid to work in different places around the world, and has to shut itself down. And on top of that is dealing with this terrible blockade. People are suffering. The only reason is a domestic reason of the power of Cuban Americans, particularly in southern Florida. And that's an example of why we have to get organized and effective here in the U.S., those of us who care about people around the world, to be a counterweight and say, we won't allow our government to keep imposing these brutal sanctions on other countries. I mean, it's the height of imperial hubris to say, not only will we deny our companies the right to trade with Cuba, but we don't want companies around the world to do that. And that is what the United States is doing. That's what Trump was doing. And now, unfortunately, Biden hasn't changed those policies.
Well, Medea Benjamin, the United States certainly isn't reducing its military spending, not reducing its military imprint on the globe. And we can't help but notice in past years, including under Obama Biden, the kind of recurring saber rattling of ghosts of the Cold War, if you will, whether it was in the Ukraine working with the coup there, backing the neo-Nazis, and now all the way here through where we've been hearing a lot in the last several years about Russia, like it's 1950s again, and of course, China. And so what's happening there? What's going on with this pivot and ramping up a Cold War with China in the Biden administration?
Well, we see it really full blast with the Biden administration, not only in the rhetoric, but also in the actions. They just had a meeting in the Pacific with countries to figure out how we're going to work together to confront China. And the U.S. under Biden is using trade, militaristic, and all kinds of ways, including getting very hawkish people in his administration to ramp up this Cold War with China. And this has the effect of not only creating a dangerous situation in the region with U.S. aggressive war games that continue to go on, but also is something that justifies a continuing buildup of U.S. military budget. And now when they talk about the pivot to China that Obama wanted to do but couldn't get out of the Middle East, that Trump wanted to do but didn't completely do because he was still bogged down. Now this is the goal of the Biden administration, to really turn U.S. attention to China and to beef up the U.S. military to be able to confront a nuclear power. And China, as a result, has increased its budget because it feels so threatened and surrounded by U.S. bases. And that then justifies, in turn, a new arms race with the United States.
And in that region, Biden seems to be continuing the sanctions and threats and so forth, as you write in your article, regarding North Korea.
Well, yes, it's interesting that rumors just surface about how the Biden administration has reached out to North Korea and that the North Korean government hasn't responded. But you have to put that in context of how much Kim Jong-un put his faith in the meetings with Trump, and nothing ever came of it. Sanctions were not lifted. There was never a peace treaty. And in fact, there were efforts to stop the North and South from their own attempts at reconciliation, unification of families, a restarting of a trade zone so that they could have commerce between the North and the South. And that has been continuing under Biden, with no lessening of the sanctions. Now, instead of just putting out the word and saying, we'd like to talk to you, if they put out the word and said, we understand that during this pandemic, sanctions are even more cruel and biting. And so we recommend and are going to move to lift a number of those sanctions. And let's talk about that. I'm sure then in that case, you would get the North Koreans to the table right away. But do they want to sit down again and be burned by the United States to get nothing out of talks? No.
Medea Benjamin, you know, in addition to calling out many of these challenges and issues we see around the world with U.S. imperialism and the devastating consequences, the assaults on human rights and so forth, you, of course, you're in the long haul here. You've been working, by example, for a progressive way forward in U.S. foreign policy. At the center, of course, you place the U.N. Charter as far as core principles of the charter that should be guiding the Biden foreign policy. Could you talk a little bit about what you'd like to see and what you've been working to create for so many years?
Well, one is that we have to shift the money. At a time when we're dealing with a pandemic, with a climate crisis, with obscene inequality in this country, need for infrastructure, there is a huge pot of gold, and that is the Pentagon budget. And since none of these threats that we face today can be dealt with by the military, it is certainly time to shift a good portion of that money into these other national security issues. So we'd like to see significant reduction of the Pentagon budget. And as we do that, we'd like to see significant attention on diplomacy. And we see in the past that when we have reached out to Cuba and to Iran and to Russia, like with the START Treaty, the results have been very positive. And that should be an indication that the perfectly viable alternatives and the ones that will have real results are the ones that are not military. And so bringing our troops home from Afghanistan and Iraq is something that we should push Biden to do, using the United Nations instead of any unilateral types of interventions is something we should do. And then really pushing to shift the money away from the Pentagon into domestic needs and other international ways that we can help people instead of hurting them.
Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange, Code Pink Women for Peace, author of 8 books, including most recently Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Medea Benjamin co-authored recently with Nicholas J.S. Davies this article titled 10 Problems with Biden's Foreign Policy and One Solution. You can see it at codepink.org, progressive.org, other places online. We will link it in the social media connection to this program and this episode of the Project Censored Show. Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for everything that you continue to do. And thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule, including in the middle of another protest, to talk to us on the Project Censored Show.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mickey.
That was our conversation with Medea Benjamin. Up next on the Project Censored Show, the Complete Picture Project. We'll talk about restorative justice and this very important social justice cause. Stay tuned.
Stop all day and it glows all night. Factory smoke and a settling light. I face the day with my head caved in. Looking like something that the cat brought in. I still be an invisible sun.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we are going to talk to filmmakers who aim to curb mass incarceration and unfair sentencing. This is a project called Complete Picture, completepicture.org. Incarceration in the U.S. has increased by 500% in the last 30 years. This is not due to an increase in crime, but rather to more punitive sentencing laws and policies. Half of all prisoners are incarcerated for a drug offense. The U.S. imprisons more people per capita than any other country in the world. Black, brown, and poor defendants are more likely to be incarcerated than their white and middle-class counterparts, and they face longer sentences. In this segment of the Project Censored Show, I'm going to welcome filmmakers Rebecca Grace and John Gray. They've set out to change these staggering statistics by revealing the whole stories of the people behind them. And their nonprofit organization is called Complete Picture. Let me introduce our guests. Rebecca Grace is the founder and CEO at Complete Picture. When Rebecca was 14, she, along with her single mother and 4 siblings, informally adopted 7 orphans, growing their family to 13 and living continuously on the brink of homelessness. Her fascination with story construction compelled her to seek a degree in film at Cal Arts, and after graduation, she continued her career as a CG animator in Los Angeles. During this time, Rebecca wrote and directed Shards, a feature film about a young girl's struggle to relate to her father with post-war PTSD. Shards premiered at the historic Man Chinese Theater in Hollywood, and she now collaborates with like-minded community leaders in the pursuit of a more equitable justice system. Rebecca Grace, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also, I welcome John Gray, producer and marketing director at Complete Picture. John Gray is an art director, marketing director, writer, illustrator, visual designer, and videographer. He has over 25 years experience with companies like Disney, Warner Brothers, HBO, Nintendo, DDB Needham, and Nickelodeon. After recovering from a 10-year bout with addiction and serving a sentence for drug possession, John joined Complete Picture, where he's grateful to have found a way to transform his mistakes into a constructive solution for others in similar circumstances. John Gray, welcome to the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you for having me on.
Rebecca and John, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join us on the show today. What you focus on is one of the underreported and censored kind of stories that we've covered at Project Censored for a long time. So I was delighted when a mutual friend of ours, Lauren Agrano, who does publicist work, introduced me to your important work. And so I thank her for helping set up this interview with you today. Rebecca, let's start with you. Could you tell us a little bit about what led you to found Complete Picture, and tell our listeners what exactly is Complete Picture?
Complete Picture, what we do is we create videos that humanize individuals being sentenced to prison. So we go into the homes of defendants right after they've been found guilty, but before they've been sentenced. And we create these really in-depth, sensitive documentaries. I mean, we spend hundreds of hours on each film. And we actually collaborate with other previously incarcerated filmmakers in the creation of these videos. And then we put all this attention and time into each video for it to just be viewed by one audience member, which is the judge who's deciding that defendant's fate. What started out as an experiment turned out to be quite impactful. Our first six videos resulted in a reduction of over 20 years of prison time for the first six defendants and saved taxpayers over $1.5 million in incarceration.
That's amazing work. And so, Rebecca, I want to focus on one of the elements there that you pointed out. You said that all of this work is designed to catch the attention of one person, right? A judge in a case. So explain a little bit about that for a minute. That's a fascinating way to use your skills as a storyteller, as a filmmaker. And obviously, you just told us about reduced sentencing and saving taxpayers money, but there's a serious human element here. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you're really trying to introduce a more holistic human perspective of people that are going through these challenging circumstances. Is that correct?
I think what we're trying to do is really raise the bar in terms of what fair representation and due process looks like in our system.
By the way, our listeners out there, you can learn more at completepicture.org. John, let's bring you into the conversation here. You have a past that has led you on the path that you're now on with Rebecca in Complete Picture. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you got involved in this really interesting and important work?
A number of years ago, I unfortunately had a pretty strong crack addiction. And it ended up making it so I was facing prison, looked like between 3 to 5 years. And I only had a few minutes once I was arrested and facing that. I only had like three different times where I was able to actually speak with a public defender. I usually had between maybe 30 seconds and a minute each time with this public defender. That's all I was granted. And basically, I was guilty and I knew it. But I didn't know anything about my rights or anything like that. And I felt stupid for being there in the first place.
I'd like to just add that John and I, we've been together about 20 years. So at this point, I had been in a relationship with someone who was addicted to crack for 10 years. And we had tried so hard for many, many years to be able to find the money to afford John to go to rehab, because that would have avoided all of the crimes, the nonviolent crimes that John committed in order to feed his habit. And it just got worse and worse as the years went on. And so because there's really no safety net in our society, rehab is out of reach for so many people.
Very expensive.
This happened in 2010, and a lot of the defendants we work with are being granted court-ordered rehab now. John would have embraced that opportunity. It was not offered.
I was immediately sent to a long term, actually, in prison.
For anyone out there who's ever had to stand by like helplessly as right. Your loved one is taken to jail, it's really a devastating experience because our jails and prisons are violent, disease-ridden, unsupervised, dangerous places where human rights are just denied on a grand scale. And I felt so powerless every single day while John was gone.
And the funny thing is that imprisonment was not a cure for me whatsoever. It was just a punishment. And when I got out, my first thought again was to score again. And I did. And it took me about another 6 months, I think, after being released on probation, that I finally just thought enough is enough and I'm not doing this anymore. And I stopped it.
I also want to add that he saw things in prison that people describe in war zones. Guards bludgeoning a person's head against the wall until he was unconscious because he asked for his medication. A young man found a way to slit his wrist, and John screamed at the top of his lungs for help for 45 minutes. And by the time the guards came, the young man was dead.
They finally came in. They dragged him out. They were like put off. They did not want to be in there. They did not want to drag him out by his feet, but they did. And all I saw was this trail of blood down the hallway as they carried him away. There was no remorse by them whatsoever for this young man. Nothing I could do about it. It was just terrible. That was one among many, many, many situations that I experienced when I was in there. It's a place of punishment. It is not a place where they're going to try to get anybody better.
There's studies that show that when a person's been in prison for a year, their mental health is worse than when they went in. Half of people in prison have been diagnosed with a mental health illness. 50% of people in federal prison are there for a drug-related crime, so they're really struggling with addiction themselves. And we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that prisons are not rehabilitation centers. They're not places where people can go to heal. They're traumatic places that cause more harm. And so what we would really like to see happen in the United States is we would like to see us turn away from punitive forms of punishment, such as prison, and start really focusing more on preventative measures like increasing the safety net for people to get social services, to go to community college, to get mental health diagnoses when they feel like they have PTSD or they're having anxiety, so that they don't end up self-medicating with drugs. And if they do get addicted to drugs, to have affordable, accessible rehabilitation so that they don't have to wait until they finally are facing a prison sentence and have it be court ordered, but then also have this stiff sentence that they're facing.
Once I was taken into custody, and Rebecca had pleaded and tried everything she could to get me out of that situation and tried to get me help, but they wouldn't have none of it. I think that was a catalyst that really made it so that when I did get out, we decided that we would not only try to help others so that they wouldn't end up in the same position without anyone helping, with their story not being able to be told to the judge and why they shouldn't be sent to prison, instead why they needed therapy or medical help or training of some sort. So that's what really sparked Complete Picture 11 years ago.
You know, in a lot of ways, what you're describing is really a plea and a push for restorative justice, for different kinds of attention that people with challenges have in our society. And again, I can't help knowing the history of how this mass incarceration in the U.S. in particular, there's a real intersectional element to it. People of color, people in lower economic brackets, women or younger people really get ensnared or entrapped in this punitive system. That's really not much about justice at all, it seems. And the perspective of people that are going through the system are rarely in our corporate media. People like you, John, rarely get the chance to tell that story.
Absolutely. That's why the rate of recidivism is so high.
And I want to say that something that we've come to really understand while making these videos is that people can change, people can heal. They can transform their lives. When individuals are given opportunities to get therapy so that they can work with an expert to talk about their childhood trauma, their sexual abuse, so that they can get help with their substance use disorders or get a psychological assessment and maybe realize that they need medication, they do heal. And I think that one of the really overreaching causes of mass incarceration is this pervading sense of hopelessness in our society, that people can't change and can't heal and that they're not worth saving. And I think that prison has become a reservoir for people our society has given up on, not the people we need to be protected from, but the people we want to protect ourselves from remembering. We're putting people there that we just kind of want to shut the door on and look the other way because we've lost hope. I just want to say there is so much hope. We see people all the time fully recovering and changing their lives.
Rebecca and John, your story alone is so important because you took things that were happening in your own lives and you transformed them in ways to be tools for other people, tools to address so many of the injustices that are in our current system. And it is a prison system. It seems much less a justice system than a system of punishment, as John so succinctly and aptly put it. I want to remind our listeners that we are talking to filmmakers Rebecca Grace and John Gray. They are the creative force behind the nonprofit Complete Picture, completepicture.org. After this brief musical break, we're going to return to our conversation with Rebecca and John, and we'll talk more about Complete Picture. Stay with us on the Project Censored Show. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're joined by filmmakers Rebecca Grace and John Gray. They are the force behind the nonprofit CompletePicture.org. They create video profiles of defendants facing sentencing that show the full humanity of those staring down the most punitive criminal justice system in the world. These revealing video portraits are commissioned by defense attorneys and shared with judges as they weigh sentencing options. So, Rebecca and John, again, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today to talk about this very important project and your story. We're dealing with a system here where prisoners are treated more unjustly, and societally, we have a lot of misconceptions about what happens in prisons, and in particular, what's happening with nonviolent crimes. You mentioned that half of the people in prison are there on nonviolent drug offenses. So could you both talk a little bit about that and how you see your film project working to counteract some of the prevailing myths in our society about these matters?
Our criminal justice system has grown into a serial abuser of the poor, the mentally ill, the addicted, disabled people, and of people who belong to a minority group. There are several key reasons for mass incarceration. I'll just kind of list them. First of all, the over-policing of poor neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color. The second one is incarcerating people for minor crimes. The third one is that prosecutors often can gain professionally by achieving stiff sentences, harsh sentences. And so they do that oftentimes without really taking into consideration what that's going to inflict on that individual who has to serve that sentence or their family. That also reminds me of another thing that I don't want to forget to circle back on, which is that it's important to note that there's not only just a monetary cost for incarceration, but there's a human cost. Every time a person is incarcerated, it extends a blow to their family and their community. They are no longer there to parent their children. Their children end up in foster care oftentimes. One in every 14 children has an incarcerated parent. Perhaps they were caring for an elderly person. Now that elderly person becomes part of the system and they have to be put into a home. Or maybe they just pass away without that love that they relied on. They're not there to maintain their job and to pay taxes. Perhaps they were a music teacher at their church. For example, that's one of the defendants we made a video for. He's taught 30 or 40 kids music over the past 20 years, and now his church community has lost his services. So the effects are far-reaching. I don't even think you can put a monetary value on that. And so let me go back to the fourth reason for mass incarceration is that, which something I touched on a little earlier, is that public defenders are just overburdened and don't have enough time to offer full representation. And then finally, and the one that we're really focusing on, is that judges don't have the information that they need to really make a good decision, a fair decision. They just don't have enough information. And so what Complete Picture is doing is we're going into this person's family. We pull together the individual's family members, but also their community members, their clergy, employers, their teachers from school. And by telling the full story of the circumstances that led up to that person's crime, it always reminds me of a novel, how seemingly inconsequential small circumstances like add up to equating to a person actually committing a crime. Not only that, but how the person since their crime has really worked to transform their lives, to fully recover from addiction, to get the therapy that they needed all along, to even get college degrees. And yet at the end of all of that, after they've completely transformed their lives, they're still forced to serve these long prison sentences, 5 to 10 years, even after all this recovery has taken place.
The war on drugs, as it's routinely called, has left some serious carnage over the decades, going back to the Nixon years, when even then, Nixon's own study on what was happening with the so-called war on drugs clearly showed that incarceration was not the antidote, and Nixon threw the report in the trash. This has been known for decades. But John, I wanted to come back to you because you lived this. Your lived experience is what really has motivated you to try to offer to others those types of opportunities that you yourself would have but didn't get to benefit from.
Yeah, there was one guy that was in there, and he was looking at doing 20 years for selling marijuana, like a little tiny baggie of marijuana, maybe half an ounce, to a narcotics officer. And it was his third time. And then I don't know if they still have that three strikes law, but at that time they did. And he was looking doing 20 years to life for that. And I felt so sorry for the guy, because when I thought about that, 20 years of a person's life for a little bit of marijuana. And he had realized once he had sold it, he thought, oh, damn, what am I going to do now? I'm in it for the rest of my life. So he had to say goodbye to his family, everybody that he knew, the life that he had. And he had been out of prison for about maybe 2 years. Now he's looking at the rest of his life in there. And that's not an anomaly. That is like so common. That's what I was saying about the recidivism. Instead, people should be given a chance to, especially for a nonviolent crime like that, they should be given a chance at rehab or therapy. They need to do an evaluation on everybody that's in there, that is in there for a minor crime, and not just think, throw away the key on them. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give everybody a voice so that they are a human being standing in front of the judge and not just a piece of paper that states this person is a bad person.
And you know what's interesting is when we first enter a defendant's home with our film crew, we're really met with suspicion because of the way they've been treated throughout the process.
Sometimes hostility.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Sometimes they're not even happy to see us.
Well,
and
they're not treated well. And the media doesn't treat these people well at all. They don't treat them fairly at all. They don't treat them like people. They treat them as perps.
But when they realize that these people who are there to interview them have walked in their shoes, almost immediately their hearts open and they are willing to share all of the most intimate details of their lives that we need to hear. We need them to open up so that we can really explain to the judge. They tell us things they haven't even told their own family members, and they certainly haven't told their federal defense attorney who they've maybe spent, 5 minutes with.
Also, being that I have had a past like that, one particular person that I went and was talking with, he had clammed up, afraid to talk. He thought, this is not going to go well for me. They're going to throw away the key on me. And I sat with him and I said, I've been in the same position you are. Hopefully it'll all work out in the end, which fortunately it did. And I said, but the thing is, just talk to Rebecca on camera, tell her your story, tell her exactly what went down. Don't hold back. Don't lie. Just be truthful about exactly what happened. And slowly but surely, he kind of came around, and they do. And then we get the story we need.
And actually, I find that just the act of us creating these stories is transformative for the defendant, because for the first time, maybe in 20 years or maybe in their life, they're actually hearing from all of their closest family members and community, neighbors and teachers, and like I said, clergy and everyone from their community, how they're valued and why they're loved and needed. And there's so much shame that comes with having committed a crime. And this gives this defendant such a lift and helps them set themselves on a new path. This ritual really is what it is, of being embraced by the people around them, even though they've made a mistake.
Rebecca and John, your website is completepicture.org. Really appreciate the information you're sharing and the anecdotes that you're sharing. Very powerful. And on your website, you have who's on your team. You've got a number of fantastic people, including Matthew Clare, sociologist and professor at Stanford, author of Privilege and Punishment, How Race and Class Matter in Criminal Court. You've been able to amass a really great collection of people. They've got a lot of data and scholarship behind this. Talk a little bit about the people you work with.
Our board members are fantastic. They are genuinely concerned about being able to try to do what they can do to help this cause. They're active members. They are just like you said, Matthew Clare is a professor at Stanford. We have a rabbi at a congregation, Beth Jacob, and she also is doing everything she can to try to help us out. Dr. Jenny Singer,
she's a forensic psychologist, and
amazing woman. And she interviews defendants all the time and tries to help them to get either a lighter sentence or to get the medical help that they need, the therapy.
And then Dr. Chris Shade, who is one of the world's leading experts on addiction.
And you also have great testimonials from defense attorneys.
The defense attorneys, every single one of them has attributed the reduction in sentence to our film.
One more thing, Rebecca and John, you have an amazing part of your website that talks about brain science and how stories engage our minds and your storytellers. And this is what you're doing, and this is what's so impactful. The people that you're talking with to elevate their voice are the very people that lack an opportunity and a platform to be heard in many cases, right? So can you talk a little bit about that? Because you're both amazing storytellers.
Well, especially Rebecca. She starts talking with them. She hugs them. And they just cannot say enough on camera. She is absolutely an amazing storyteller.
Well, I've always believed that the greatest responsibility we have to one another is how we perceive and judge one another. That's why it's so important to listen and open one's heart. Stories do build a feeling of tolerance and empathy for one another.
That's like her videos. When the judge sees those documents that are in front of him, it's like going to put him to sleep. It's like same old. Right, but then when he sees our video, it's like, wow, I had no idea that this person has come this far, has really turned their life around, shows remorse. I don't think that this person is going to do another bad thing.
It not only puts a face on the individual, but it reignites hope in the judge, right? Because at the beginning of this conversation, I was saying that I think mass incarceration is a result of a pervasive feeling of hopelessness that people can't change, that people, once they're broken for good. And our videos prove that that's just not the case. Judges say that they watch our videos over and over and over again.
Well, Rebecca Grace and John Gray, I know I've been inspired by the work you're doing, and I'm relatively new to your project. So I have great appreciation for the work you're doing and giving back to society and trying to help others. And I really appreciated your story and your time today. CompletePicture.org is the website. Rebecca Grace and John Gray, thank you again so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you, Mickey.
Thank you so much, Mickey.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Stay well. We'll see you next time. Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.